welcome to this Consumer Duty Alliance good practice and due diligence session. We have two tremendous speakers that are joining us. Frankly, in the preparation for it, we couldn't stop them talking. There was so much we were covering. Between now and about 12:45, we're going to discuss a number of subjects. And then we have got, thank you all, we've got some great questions that have been shared by everybody. And we'll be getting to as many of those questions as we can. In the interests of speed, there are various other resources we can make available to you on this. So certain things that we are not going to cover in this session, a number of people will have been at our Empowering Advice Through Technology conference back in January, where there was a tremendous plenary session on this, on the overall subject of due diligence and after artificial intelligence generally. You can see there brief details of Paul was on that session together with Neil Letitha and Helen Lovett. Jesse has just dropped a link in the chat. I would urge you to go and have a listen to that. It's a really, really good session about all things AI generally. It's free to advisors for access. You'll need to register to get access to it, but there's no charge for being registered. We just announced today that we will be holding a conference. It should be AIFA 2024, Artificial Intelligence in Financial Advice, 10th of July in Central London. Great, there'll be 24 firms demoing state-of-the-art AI for financial advisors, three plenary sessions, one on onboarding clients, another one on compliance, another one on compliance using AI, and the third one on client reviews. Tickets are already selling fast. I saw Mr. Miller, you've bought your ticket this already, sir. Thank you very much. We do have, and we are maintaining, an annual technology survey. If you find this session useful, and I really hope you will, I would ask after the event, if you could, Jesse will be sending you out your feedback forms, which will have a link to the survey. It would help us greatly in making sure we're properly understanding what advisors want. If you could complete that for us, it's been deliberately designed to only take 15 to 20 minutes. There is a link. Jesse's just dropped the link in there. And then lastly, we do a series of advice tech forums, which many of you I know come to. Any of you that don't, there is one on the 28th of February, which is all about getting more use and getting more value, particularly out of the technology that you already pay for. We've got a number of firms together who are getting really good returns on their tech, and we've got them to agree to share views on that. You can register for that session, and Jesse's just dropped the link in the diary. So moving on very quickly, today we are going to talk about the differences between predictive and generative AI. We're going to cover that quite quickly. We're then going to move on to talk about the practical uses and benefits of AI in advisor firms. You'll have the tremendous benefit of Howard's experience on due diligence with AI and also Paul's. We'll talk about how you can create your own AI policy. That's really important. And look at the potential risks to firms. Now, I'm assuming that we're all on Teams, and I'm assuming these days everybody's got a certain amount of experience on how to use it. I would say, if you are not talking, could you please keep yourselves on mute? Equally, when you do come to talk, please remember to take yourselves off mute. And I would encourage you, we always find with these meetings, if you've got comments or observations, please drop them in the chat for two reasons. One, we'll try and pick them up as much as we can when we're going through the session, but you will also find other people sharing views in the chat. And we, you know, at the end of the event, we frequently find we've got two really good conversations that have gone on. The one that's all about the actual session, and then a great debate that's gone on in the chat. So any thoughts, feelings, questions you've got, I would encourage you go into the chat and add those. If you want to ask a question at any point, you know, please use the raise hand icon and I will endeavour to come to you as quickly as I can. So just flicking forward now, our two main speakers today. Paul Miller is Chief Information and Data Protection Officer at IWP UK. How many advice firms have you got in the organisation, Paul, now?
I started off at sort of 33, but we are obviously sort of amalgamating them down. So I think we've got an estate of about 27 currently.
You're a very diverse range of experience, it's fair to say. And you've been on other sessions previously and shared a lot about data practice. You live your life in that space, really, don't you?
It's my favourite subject, Ian.
Every time we talk, I learn some more. And then coming on to somebody that has spoken a little bit earlier, Howard Freeman. I've known for several years. He does a great job for us as an outsourced data protection officer and keeping us the right side of complex legislation. It's inevitable. AI is going to throw up a whole load of issues, and I know some of the subjects that we're going to talk about. So I think if I can come perhaps... Paul, can I invite you to, one last thing. At the end of the session, you will get a feedback form. Anybody that wants attendance certificates for your record keeping for continuous education, please, you know, when you complete your feedback forms, they'll come out to you. We really do appreciate your feedback. It helps us make sure that we can get the right sessions and the right subjects for you in the future. I'm going to take the presentation off screen so we can all see people better. And ask Paul to give us a brief explanation, if you'll be so kind, of the differences between predictive and generative AI.
You're still sharing your screen, Ian, by the way. A beautiful picture of, it looks like a desert or a field of some sort.
Hopefully gone now, sorry.
Yeah, all gone.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, the two pieces that are on there at the moment are the predictive side and the generative side. Predictive AI is, as you can imagine, it's the old sort of like historical performance is no measure of future sort of returns, but predictive AI tries to work out those future returns by looking at historical data. So just put simply, it's no simpler than that, really. Generative AI is the new kid on the block. It generates its new content, which is quite exciting for people like me, tech geeks, because of the fact that generative AI now can not only generate images and text, stories it can write, it can, there's all sorts of things, video it can also build, and also data sets. And that gives it the opportunity then to build data for its own training. So it can essentially self-learn. It's not really self-learning, but it is self-training. And that's a big point, really, to measure with that. So if you haven't got a good data set or you've got biases that are built into data sets, generative AI can build you an unbiased data set or a bias swinging the other way to try and level the playing field out a little bit. It doesn't quite work, but it's getting there. Pretty good.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject, generative AI, because we also have you'll come across little things like hallucinations, which if generative AI doesn't know the answer, it has a nasty habit of making it up, which is why you have to be really, really careful on your due diligence. Whereas, predictive AI, I remember looking at some stuff with IBM Watson, with a specific financial services model they were building a couple of years ago. And Watson, if it didn't know, it'd say, I don't know, but if the answer might be X, whereas there are some quite amusing examples of I think it was Google Bard that came up with a statement about the first off-Earth pictures of the universe have been taken, and it cited that they've been taken about 2004, but the satellite that they cited hadn't actually been launched until 2019. And then there is apparently a true case where a lawyer in the States had used it to find some precedents, and the AI had completely made the precedents up, and he introduced them into the court and apparently got in a whole lot of trouble. So that's why we need to be really careful about things like that. So just having called those differences out, let's move on and talk about some practical benefits of AI for advisor firms. Paul, I'm going to come straight back to you, actually. Do you want to talk through a few of the things that you've used in your experience?
I think one of the big things for me has always been I come from an execution only background, so an execution only client, self service. So if they want a new account, they want a new client setting up, they tend to set themselves up, and that's right through. It's a straight through process, and that includes setting their own details up, going through KYC checking, AML checking, right the way through to actually sort of like getting the account open and choosing the product they want. And then they're on a portal, they can self-service on that particular portal. And some of those AI tools now that do that, AML and KYC checking, they were quite cool. I used a bit of kit a few weeks back, which has evolved a lot since the last time I used it, which was about 3 years ago, called OnFido, which essentially took you through an AML and KYC check to verify who you were. So essentially you did a selfie with your driving license up. It took a scan of your face, the scan of the face on the driving license. It picked up your name and address and driving license number from that driving license. It made sure your face matched the key points on the driving license itself. You uploaded a scan image of your passport. It then did a sort of three-way check between you and the passport details. And it also got options then to log into things like the government digital ID point to make sure that you are who you say you are and your passport is registered correctly in the right address. And that's a big win, as Howard sort of pointed out when we were sort of talking last week about the fact that straight away you're into the realms then where people don't need physical copies of passports lying around in files or desks or whatever else. And that takes all of that process online and puts it into a nice little neat little package which can be protected given the right IT systems. So that's a big win for me. And then you're onto the major benefit then is the portal moving forward. A proper digital engagement portal can then allow the clients to keep their own data updated, which is things that change: email address, home address, mobile phone numbers, home phone numbers, etc. So that's a big win for me for those.
Howard, do you want to talk a little bit more? I mean, as Paul mentioned, we did talk about this in our preparation call, that, you know, the challenges that come for firms from keeping evidence for KYC that can inadvertently give them a data breach.
Indeed, that's it. Yeah, it's very important. One of the things we've always said, and this is where we've always come into conflict with the Financial Conduct Authority and HMRC, is from a data protection standpoint, I don't want you keeping images of people's passports. If you lose those images, in theory, they're going to lose their identities. And the consequences of that are severe. And if it can be proven that it's you, you've got several things to worry about. One, immediate compensation, which is £2,000 under the GDPR. Two, the Information Commissioner's Office is going to want a word, which is never good. And the associated publicity that goes with that, because they love to tell people what action they've taken. And then finally, the lawyers. If you wonder where all the PPI lawyers went, I can tell you most of them headed for data protection. And we've seen some classic cases. There's a case of a customer of ours who the data had been lost. Let's deal with that first and foremost. And under the GDPR, you're entitled to £2,000 of immaterial losses. We agreed a fee at £1,000 because the claim of stress was not really there. But we then got a letter from the solicitor claiming £8,500 worth of legal expenses. Their cost architect must have been some sort of fantasist, we eventually agreed 750 quid and sent him away with his tail between his legs. But it just goes to show that the consequences of holding sensitive data and high value data, such as passports and driving licenses, which if you give me your driver's license and a passport, there's a lad in my local pub who will get credit cards in your name within hours. It is not difficult to do. Once you've got someone's identity and all the pieces are fitted together, you can get onto Facebook. You can probably break through into Facebook. You get into personal email accounts and you are up and running. The spot price this morning for a passport image, full identity plus driving license is $296.24 on the dark web. Organized crime will buy this data from people and sell it on. And there are plenty of people out there who want to buy it. The argument I've had continually with HMRC and the Financial Conduct Authority is you should not be holding this data. And they're saying, yes, they should. If we audit them, chances are fairly slim. Then we want to know, bang fist on table type approach, that they did know their customer. And I've always argued that a suitably competent and qualified financial advisor should have the authority to sign off and say, yep, I saw, I'll pick on Sarah because she's right in the middle of my screen. I saw Karen and Sarah Keys this morning and there was a true likeness and I'm happy that she is who she says she is. But of course, HMRC don't want that. So this method of AI that Paul spoke of you not actually touching the passport, I think is fabulous.
Right.
HMRC can't argue it. It's even better.
Well, that's the brilliant one. Let's continue that. Also, you were going to talk a little bit about AI and compliance and Zoom particularly.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. One of the things that Paul just spoke about was obviously AI needs to train and it self-trains. I think to say that it self-learns, we're not quite at Skynet levels yet. The rise of the machines isn't quite with us yet. There's been a lot of hype around that, particularly by the BBC. But it can self-train. What Zoom did last year was they told all their customers, we are going to use your data, so that's your imagery, your conversations, your documents that you shared, presentations. On Zoom, we're going to use it to train our AI engine. And you can't opt out. Well, I'm sorry, there are laws. They basically came under so much pressure from not only the state of California and a couple of other US states who have data protection laws. The European Union's Data Protection Board launched, and most governments said, you're just not doing it. And they have pulled back from it because it was just, what happened was, as this was announced, the Microsoft share price went up $20 as Zoom's went down $20. So you can see how popular that was with the markets. And the problem you've got with AI, in the UK, there is no specific law. There is one in the EU, which I have been reading. And believe you me, I might look a bit grey. I'm only 21. It's the most tedious law I've ever read. And that includes the GDPR in that. But it does make a huge heap of sense. But in the UK, there's no AI law. But you have to remember there are data protection laws. There's two at the moment with one more coming. GDPR, Data Protection Act 2018. You've got laws on HR data. You've got laws on intellectual property. If you don't use AI properly and don't consider these laws in the proper policy, you will fall foul of various regulators. So you can't just do, as the news has been saying, people, oh, do what the hell you like with AI. You can't. There are rules and there are laws in place. The one thing there isn't is an AI law, but I don't necessarily think we need it because we've got other laws to protect us. And as Zoom found out, you can't just take a load of people's data. And the classic example with Zoom is there's a networking organization called BNI. I think some of you will know BNI. In fact, look, I've even got the mug. Look, there, look, I've got the mug. It's a bit battered because and BNI have a contract with Zoom. And referral networking is dodgy from a data protection point of view anyway, because if Ian wants his wall painting and I refer him to a decorator, I may have passed Ian's data without consent. So there's lots of issues there. But for BNI, it was an absolute no, you can't do this. Because we're already, the regulator in the UK is already looking at us in a big way. Please go away with this. So it's, but the people in BNI would have had no choice. If BNI hadn't thought the corner, they would have had no choice and would have fallen foul of Zoom's AI teaching engine.
Ian. So is that a good point to come on and look, you know, we've covered things on GDPR, but let's look explicitly at due diligence in AI tools and how you should be, you know, how firms should be approaching them. You know, would you like to give us a few do's and don'ts, Howard?
I'd like to give you a load of don'ts, Ian, to be honest. But that's because I'm a data protection type. And but the one thing that I've learned with 450 customers is that GDPR cannot be a business blocker. I've got to come into a company, and when I've dealt with Ian and dealt with Poppy, the one thing I've got to try and do is keep them on the right side of the law, but I've got to keep the business working. And it's finding this balance. Which is where I use discretion, a little bit of skill, and sometimes blatant negotiation with the Information Commissioner on certain things. So if you're going to consider an AI tool, first question I will always ask you is, where is the data going? Where is it going to be stored, processed? So if Paul's KYC and AML tools, which sound fantastic, are hosted in India, I'm going to say no, and I'm going to say no, end of. If they're in the States, I'm going to say, okay, IDTA, we can get around that one. That's not a problem. We want to see some information around the security of what they're doing, and probably get them to comply to GDPR whilst they're at it. So again, we're looking at where, what, why, who, where is the data going? Are they then sharing that with other AI tools where some learning might be going on? And it's the lack of controls that we need to get to the bottom of. So I mean, I imagine with AML and KYC tools, they've probably been through a process, because if this thing's got FCA compliance attached to it, then the chances are they've been through the mill with the FCA. But before you pick up any AI tool where personal data is going to be transferred, and in your business it's personal and financial data, you must know where the data is, where they're going to share it with. We need to see some policies from them on GDPR. We need to see policies on whether sharing data, whether there's data sharing agreements in, and obviously locations. And we also need to understand what they're doing. They need to be transparent with you. And that's the big one, because a lot of companies say, yeah, we do this, that, to deliver our service, which is a vague statement. We need them to be transparent. And if they are using 25 sub-processors across the subcontinent, we need to not only know that they're doing that, we need to know who they are and where they are.